in cycles, people talk about being in like the seventh inning. We've been in the seventh inning for years and years and years. So just to kick things off, I wanted to ask you guys where we are in this cycle. But since we have a basketball person here and a football person here, I'm hoping we can find another metaphor than inning so that we can really drill down on where you think we are in this current cycle. Not that there's anything against baseball. My husband is an Astros fan, so we watched a lot, but there can be some long innings.
When you say cycle, I assume you're talking about how long this, what's been going on, how long that's going to last before we end up having a recession.
Yeah. End of a cycle, kind of the trough.
I think the way to look at it is you're in the ninth inning. I don't think you're in the seventh inning. I think you're in ninth inning with a two-hour rain delay. And that rain delay, we see it's continuing, and you're like, it's got to end soon. We all know the rain's going to stop, but that's how I would look at it. You've ended up, over the course of last year, you've gone from a 3% GDP to 2% GDP. There's a real slowdown that is happening across the United States. The job numbers, I think that's great. But at the end of the day, you're going to see that things are going to continue slowing down. And I think you'll start seeing next year.
So I'm going to pick up with the rain delay, because I think that's pretty brilliant. I think there's been multiple rain delays. And we're in the sixth inning, because if it was the sixth inning, it could be an official game. So we just had another rain delay, and that's my way of saying we've gone from boom-bust cycles, where either it was an equity bubble, like we all lived through, or some kind of a bubble that ultimately was destroyed by a policy error. And then you've gone the ground, and then you came out. That's a boom-bust cycle. We've seen so many of them. We think we're in many about the rain delays. And one of the way to think about this is a slower doesn't build up the excesses as quick as the prior excesses were built up. So you get this really, really, really long cycle. But in between, you get these rain delays, mini recessions, mini expansions. And we think we had one, a little mini recess, if you will, in the fourth quarter of these past years.
So does this super, super, super long baseball game with like lightning and torrential downpours and all sorts of horrible storms, does it ever end? Do these mini waves preclude an actual deep recession like we have seen in cycles for hundreds of years now?
I think so.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't think you're going to have, recession is two down quarters. That's hard to have. I mean, it really is. It's hard to have that with unemployment where it is. So what you've had is sort of, the retail industry has gotten absolutely clocked. Energy has gotten absolutely clocked in the last year. So I think it's exactly what you're talking about. But to get into a recession, it's going to, my point is you're going to feel like you're in a recession, because when GDP drops, GDP's dropped by 33%. That's not good. Just saying. All right? When it drops another 50%, you're not in a recession. But you're now at 1%. That's not good either. Right? So you've got to sort of look at what's going on. I don't think you're in a recession. I think you're just in a slowdown, and that's going to take a while. I think it could be 5 years.
Yeah, I would agree with Mark. I think this level of growth feels, when it drops from trend line, so 2% trend line growth, when it drops from there and it gets down into the low ones, it feels recessionary. And it causes a lot of head fakes in the market, which is what we've all seen. I would say this, though, that the engine of growth has generally been the U.S. consumer. It's even more the U.S. consumer now. And the world economy is even more services than ever before. So it's less apt to fall down from an industrial activity-driven recession, which ultimately lends itself to a longer cycle.
And Mark, you're obviously invested in a lot of industrial-driven type companies. Would you agree with that assessment, that manufacturing is no longer kind of that engine of growth that we've seen historically?
I think it's less. So I agree with that. I think it's less. I think, look, the issue is, I don't know what the numbers are, and you might know. I mean, I think the U.S. consumer used to be 60% of GDP, whether that's up to 65%. What I will tell you is that I think if, you know, it depends on who's president, but if Warren is president, I think you are going to see a real slowdown. I think you'll see consumer spending go down. It's just going to get, I think you'll start having issues. So I think you've got to look at what's going to happen. You know, that's why next year is going to be really telling, because depending on who the nominees are and what ends up happening, I think you'll see the consumer start slowing down.
Now, do you agree with Paul Tudor Jones and what he was saying earlier today about, you know, if Warren is elected, that could send the stock market down about 25%? And what 20, is it about 24. Her policies that happen? 24%?
Yeah, I mean, he's off.
Maybe like 23.5.
Yeah, 23.
Lightning persists.
What is it about her?
Cooperman said the same thing.
Yeah, we don't have a couple days to go through it. But there's a lot of issues. But just simply, it's, you know, you're going to raise, there's nothing wrong with raising taxes, but you're going to raise taxes quite a bit. You're going to have more regulation. You're going to end up, I think what you're going to find is you are going to slow down the economy. And I think the market, I think the best trade out there today is that you should go short the market the minute it's clear that Warren's the nominee. I mean, I don't know if it goes out. The nominee.
The president.
No, the nominee. Mm-hmm. Because that's when the market's going to realize there's a real possibility. Today, that's being discounted very, very heavily. I don't know if it goes down 25%, but it's definitely going down 10 to 25%. So I don't know what the number is, but it's not going up. So if you know it's not going up, the only other, it's not going down. I just can't tell you the amount, but there's going to be serious issues.
What do you think?
Well, I would take a outside of the political spectrum of things, I'd go to the CapEx route. The CapEx route has been a big missing link. The U.S. consumer has been the engine of growth. The CapEx route worldwide, we believe it's mismeasured, technically speaking. When you put a dollar into CapEx today, it goes a lot farther than it ever did. Just look at the cloud, that's one. So the actual sheer absolute dollars is not the thing. It's like how far reaching is that dollar of CapEx. And it hasn't gone as far as we all expected in the last, say, 12 to 18 months. And a lot of it has to do with, do you know the rules? Do you understand how to play the game? And with everything going on with trade and everything going on with an election year, it's hard to argue why companies have generally said, you know what, I'm going to wait. And that's kind of where we are in the cycle, which is why it's going to be hard to get to a 3% real GDP level while we're going from 6th to 7th inning. If we understood a little bit more rules and the potential downside and things like that, people, companies, investors, institutions, they can make calculated risk assessments. And it's very hard to do that.
But the cloud isn't going away, right? So, you know, in terms of CapEx kind of becoming reinvigorated, if the cloud of uncertainty, sorry for the metaphor, terrible, so much weather today, if that is lifted, does CapEx get reignited again, or have companies kind of readjusted to this world where they expect their CapEx to not be as expensive?
Yeah, I think there's two tracks to that. The first track is a lot of it has to do with demographics, so we're going to have to wait to see if this answer is correct. Probably wait a little longer than we all want. But if indeed we are going into a dual supply chain world, with one dominated by the U.S. and one dominated by China, over the next 10 to 20 years, it becomes more of a technology battle than it does a trade battle. If that's the case, and there's more onshoring that comes back to the United States, then you're going to have more automation. With more automation, you get greater productivity. With greater productivity, you get better growth. And then those CapEx dollars start to become a self-reinforcing cycle. Unfortunately, that's not in the next 2 to 3 years. And then the second track of all that is we are in an asset-light world, if that makes sense, right? Being in an asset-light world, it's very R&D heavy. It's very copyright IP heavy, and it's the dollars that go towards that aren't fully captured into something called capital investment. So that's why it looks like it's capital light in an asset light world on the way to what could be a lot higher productivity, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 years.
Yes.
I was just gonna say I'd simplify it, because I think what you said is absolutely true. Just look at it this way. All people want is certainty, right? That's all business wants, right? Do you believe you have that with President Trump? If you think you have it, like where every day tweets something new, and you don't know where you were with China the day before, and all of a sudden everything's going around, but at least, and that's why business has slowed down, that's actually why all of a sudden you're seeing a lot of movement away from China. And then if you have warned, you think you have certainty on the regulation, on the regulatory side. So that lack of certainty is why businesses are slowing down and they're not investing dollars. That's all the market wants is certainty. And if you have uncertainty, you're gonna have issues.
Uncertainty for an extended period of time.
That's correct, and you've got that right.
Then you'd expect uncertainty, you know, every once in a while. That's just history and market and politics and so forth. Now, kind of going back to what you were saying about automation, Mark, you're, you know, well known as a distressed investor out there. So I was surprised to read this headline recently that Bucks owner Mark Lazary leads $35 million. In that context.
I no longer have a first name. It's Bucks owner. My kids call me Buck.
And they just completely removed distressed investor altogether.
Right, altogether.
Leads $35 million funding round for Silicon Valley media startup. That sounds like the opposite of distressed.
It is. It's not for our company. It was me. I mean, it's...
So does that say anything about your thoughts on where we are in the cycle? Or
no, it's just, there's a gentleman I met, Carlos Watson, who I thought is a brilliant guy. I think in what he's doing, I think it's exceptionally interesting. You know, we have a family office, people come in, shockingly people want you to invest in a lot of different things. I'm sure you've never heard that. That people, if you have money, somehow find you. And somehow he found me and said, hey, here's what I'm doing. I thought he was a brilliant guy. I thought he's really smart. I like the idea. I think the headline made it sound like, you know, leads, you know, that I'm putting in a 35-34. It's a little bit less. So it's just something I thought that would be interesting and is the total opposite of what I'm doing. So I thought it was a great diversifier.
And Reuters reported, I think it was this morning or yesterday, that you're raising a $500 million venture debt fund.
Yeah.
And they put that kind of in the context of what's going on with WeWork.
Yeah. So what that is, it's actually, so the perception of what it is and what the reality of it is totally different. So what we do is we lend money to companies who are obviously raising money in the technology field or in the venture space. What's actually interesting, so it's what is the loss rate? So you're charging 10 to 12% and you lend money. If somebody just did a valuation at 100 million, you'll lend them 10. So it's 10%. They did 500 million, again, it's 10%, it's 50 million. So you're lending that amount of money and you end up are charging 10 to 15. The returns with the team that we've been doing it have been mid-teens type of returns net because of the warrants. What do you think the loan loss is on something like that? You'd be shocked. Like, you would think it'd be really high.
Yeah.
It's less than 1%. So it sounds, I think we should have a different term than venture debt, because it sounds like you're doing all these things. But for us, it's exactly what we've been doing. It's a form of direct lending to technology companies. There's a company, Hercules, I don't know if you know, it's a BDC. You can sort of look at it. They put out $10 billion. I think they've got same thing, 1% loan loss. It's a phenomenal business that people don't understand. So we think for us, we've got an edge because there just isn't that much competition. Probably after today, there will be. hopefully not. You know, you hate talking about stuff you're doing because you think, you want to explain it to people. But I think for the next 2 to 4 years, it'll be great. And then I think the returns will start coming down, or at least I hope others don't do it.
So in that article, they talked about that kind of in the context of WeWork being able to come in and help provide, some sort of lending in a more troubled venture situation. When people look at WeWork, a lot of people have said, you know, this is the poster child for the top of the cycle. This is what's wrong with our economy. This is, you know, what needs to, you know, become more of a shakeout. Do you, you're nodding your head, Chris.
I'm nodding the head because we hear a lot about
you hear that.
But this is no different than history in my regard or my view. And it's because the private markets create the opportunity set. The opportunity set may not be as wide as the public markets just by default. And when you get situations like this, ultimately there's price discovery. And price discovery isn't as easy in the private markets for a variety of reasons. It becomes itself out. Mark knows this really well. They've built in a great business off of that. And I think that's what we're seeing in this particular example, and it's not gonna be the first.
I actually think it's what's right. I mean, I think WeWork is actually, it's not what's wrong, it's what's right. The valuation is wrong, but should it have been valued at $50 billion? No. You know, where is it being valued at today? 7 to 8. Mm-hmm. Here's a great question. Does anybody know how much public bonds they have? You know, they have public debt. Do you want to know where do you want to know where it trades? 75 cents. Do you want to know how much they have? 500 million. With all the stuff that happened with WeWork, 50 billion coming down, it's a $7 billion valuation. It's your point. It's a valuation exercise, and that's all this is. In the private market, it's a lot harder because everybody's sort of basing off of hope. And in the public markets, it's easy, right? Things, I mean, Uber just announced sort of another big quarterly loss. What happened? The market went down. Right? Why? Because they announced a loss. It's not. And yet the valuation went down. And nobody's talking about that. But in WeWork, it's because we went from 50 billion to 5 billion, 50 billion. So I think it's all great. You know, somebody lost a lot of money.
Does that mean you're participating in the new credit facility that they're raising?
No, I'm not. No, because I think that's being done. You have less room there. On the bonds, you know, we had bought those bonds a while ago. We did well in those bonds. But today, you know, I don't know what the valuation on everything is, so I've got to wait. I've got to understand it more.
And that takes time.
Takes time.
You know, oftentimes when we talk about cycles, it's accompanied by debt crises of some sort. Do either of you see any pockets of excess that could lead to some sort of debt crisis, or do you think that the end of the cycle is a result of something else?
Well, I think crisis is a strong word. Debt opportunity. On an individual company-by-company basis, there's a lot of things that are interesting in the triple C space right now. But stepping back, the big debt area is really, you know, national debt, liabilities, future payments that have to be made. How do you fund it? A lot of it was discussed today. People get very creative when your back is against the wall, or when your back is through the wall, you get ultra creative. And as we watch national debt as a percentage of GDP climb, it's very hard to come up with creativity right now because it's not an issue right now. It becomes an issue starting, you know, 15, 20 years from now where debt to GDP starts to climb to alarming levels, you know, 130, 140, 150% debt to GDP, and then maybe 180 by 2040. You can deal with that right now. So the question is there a funding source out there that's not attached to an existing liability that will attach itself to that future liability once it becomes an abundant funding source? I know that sounds a little weird, but we try to create math today to grab existing funding sources, change the tax structure, change the calculus of that to attach it to a future liability. It doesn't work. Math doesn't work. But if we can find a new funding source, exportation of liquefied natural gas, tax ourselves, put that to a national debt relief fund, and pay down the debt over the next 100 years. Those are things that are not going to work right now, but they may have been.
But do you put probabilities on top of that, the probability of finding that new funding source relative to the ballooning?
I think you got to look at the abundance. What do we have an abundance of that is not currently attached to an existing liability? And that's one area that we have an abundance of in this country that is not attached to any future liability right now. Then, of course, you have to just figure out whether or not that is something that's doable based upon the amount of reserves we have and how much we're going to export, what we can bring it out of the ground and ultimately charge. Those are some things that the mathematicians in Washington should figure out at some point, but I think that's the concept.
Liabilities and leverage are two different things. Do you see any areas where leverage is becoming a problem?
I wish there was more leverage. I wish people had more.
Fewer liabilities, more leverage.
Yeah, look, I think the problem you have around the world, if you look at the U.S., I think all the banks are fine. I mean, you know, they've got 10% equity. It's fine. There's less leverage in the system. There's more, you've got more debt in the system, but that's with, you know, it's firms like ours that bought that debt or have ended up doing bilateral agreements. So I actually think there's less leverage in the system. And banks are better, so it's kind of hard to have the issues. But just to make it easy, the only time you deal with anything is when there's a crisis. Trust me, if rates move up, there's going to be, you know, the funding for the United States, that number is going to go through the roof as rates keep moving up. A year ago, if you did a poll here, I would say 90% of everybody thought rates were going up. Right? That was just a year ago. We all would have been wrong. They've only been reduced three times in the last year. Right, so what has that done? That's made funding costs even cheaper, even easier. So there's a crisis is when people are nervous, and you'll focus on this when all of a sudden, when we're paying more of GDP is on interest expense. Today, that number just keeps going down, so nobody's worried about it.
So when I talked to Ray about this earlier, Ray Dalio on CNBC, he said, you know, that kind of creates, the Fed is almost stuck now with these lower rates because of the...
You got to think logically. Why, a year ago, the economy is growing at 3%, so let's say we knew it was going to go to 2%. Why did the Fed lower rates? Who cares that the economy is going to 2%? It's like they're trying to keep it growing, and you've got this issue out there of trying to make sure this expansion is continuing. And okay, if that's what the Fed is trying to do, that's fine. But what you're gonna end up having is when we have issues, we've got nothing to deal with it.
I would agree. I think that central bank policy now includes two things, the structure of rates and the balance sheet. And the balance sheet is likely to be more important than the level of rates, even because the level of inflation is not likely to force them to raise rates. If you think the level of inflation, for a variety of reasons, is going to stay relatively static, the level of rates should stay relatively static, which means the balance sheet becomes a more powerful force in central bank policy in terms of the level of liquidity, the amount of dollars you have in circulation, etc. And if you go back to the fourth quarter of last year, it was kind of a double whammy, which is a little bit higher rates, a smaller balance sheet, less supply of dollars, cost of capital, and the strength of the dollar going up, hurting 50% of the economies overseas, which ultimately hurt industrial activity, and then we fall below trend. And the countries that had greater leverage to industrial activity fell into so-called recession. So Mark's right, and Leslie, your question's correct, which is you're in a straitjacket at this point. How do you monitor the balance sheet and the level of rates and the slope of the curve accurately without going all the way down to the zero bound? That's really
good. You can do a very simple test. Rates today are exceptionally low. Everybody's refinanced their mortgage, right? Or you should, by the way. Because it's and if you don't have a mortgage, you know, congrats. But here's the thing you should try to do. Sectors, unsecured. Go to a bank and say, I want to borrow money unsecured, see how much you get. And then see what you're paying for that. and you're going to find it's going to be somewhere around 8 or 10%. You've got these low rates. You can't really borrow. Why? Because banks don't want to take a lot of risk. Don't blame them. So what you've got out there is sort of what you're talking about. We're all stuck. I can borrow money if I don't need it. I can borrow money if I've got no issues. And companies are continuing, are paying lower and lower rates, which is actually, it's enabling people who aren't that good or companies that have issues to keep on doing okay because their cost of capital is low. It enables the U.S. government to keep on borrowing money and grow a deficit that we're not worried about because rates are low, right?
Yeah, and I think from an investment perspective, ultimately that would create some distress situations. But broadly speaking, that could potentially force money that traditionally sat in fixed income that gave you a level of return called a yield over to the equity side of the
investor.
Has to.
Equity or other risky areas, right?
Equity and if you can, the private side. Yeah.
That's why private debt is growing. It's just like our biggest growth is we can lend money today at 10 to 15%. Why? Because companies can't borrow. If you have an issue, you can't borrow. So therefore, we can dictate terms. And you're right. I mean, Chris is right. What do you want to make? You want to make 1.5%, or you want to go invest in the equity market? Right? I always think the greatest thing, you know, we all go out to dinner, usually with friends. and you go out with friends, and there's always somebody at the dinner who says, "Yeah, I made 20% last year." Yeah. Right? How'd you do? You don't want to say I made one.
Right.
Right? What are you going to say? I bought treasuries. So you go, yeah, I did too. And then you go home and your wife goes, really? And you go, no, I didn't do anything. Nobody. Look at that annoying person who's telling you he's making 20%. What do you do? You just left.
No, it's a great.
Right?
It's
we all give up.
Yeah. And it's a really simple but fantastic point, which is if you are worried about all-time highs in the equity market, forget about the number, because the index changes over time. Like, you can't say the S&P's number today is equivalent to what the makeup of the index was 20 years ago. You know, we all try to do that, but the number doesn't mean anything. It's where's the relative investment opportunity set in that versus the other things that you can apply.
So you bring up a good point, and an interesting segue to this idea of passive investing, and the fact that a lot of people, probably your friend, if he's telling
the
truth.
He's not my friend anymore. Yeah. I dropped him.
Who wants to be friends with that guy?
Yeah, who wants to be friends with somebody who's making 20% a year?
That sounds terrible.
With no risk,
right? I apologize. Yeah. I forgot that. There's nobody who ever takes risks who makes you 20 and fully liquid. Right?
Got in, got out in the fourth quarter,
yeah, got
back
out,
in
yeah,
January
got back, fourth. Right.
So smart.
Right.
Fortune teller too. But you know, when you kind of look at cycles and there's a whole book written about this time is different and you know, looking at history and how history repeats itself when it comes to these, you know, cycles and so forth. But do you see contours in today's markets that could make it different this time, whether it's through you know, the growth in passive investing or quantitative trading or, you know, other aspects, the persistence of low rates for the foreseeable future and this kind of stuff pattern that we've talked about that makes the end of the cycle actually different this time? Is that scary to say or possible?
I think Chris is right. I think if you look at it, at the end of what's changed is you've had this fundamental change from manufacturing to technology. You're seeing that happening in the economy. And everybody who's taking advantage of that is at least the value of the store, okay, got destroyed, right? Because you didn't see that trend. And I think that's what's going on. So yeah, it's never the same. All everybody talks about is the same stuff they talked about 7 years ago. I think, of course you're right. Recession starting in 2 years. Yeah, sooner or later it will. Okay, it just will. But I think we've both said, which I think and since we both agree, obviously it's true, that it's hard to have a recession. It's easy to have a slowdown.
We put the test tubes and the beakers away without mixing chemicals together that are ultimately going to cause issues. That's one. Second thing is fiscal policy is pretty constrained worldwide. There are certain countries that have a surplus that are not using their surplus now, and they're in recessionary territory. So they would have yesteryear for a variety of reasons. We have $16 trillion, or at the peak, $16 trillion in negative yielding debt. So it is very different. There are different components, and some of that was even in the high yield space.
Which is
hard to even fathom. But at the end of the day, what is the same is that economics at its core is a behavioral science.
Mm-hmm.
You're only going to do something if you have a comfort level in tomorrow or the next week or the quarter to a certain degree and access to capital. All those things are the same, but we are working in a different climate.
Well, it sounds like all of that complexity could require a drink. So luckily for all of you, it's almost that time. But I just wanted to thank both Chris and Mark for